When are we going to start to be able to feel like we're not losing control of accessing our washing machines, stoves, refrigerators, stereo systems and VCRs? We've made a lot of progress with computers, but it seems that there's a long way to go with these sorts of appliances. Well, Greg van der Heijden has been studying the whole area of accessibility for a long, long time. He's in charge of the Trace Research Center at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and he joins us for an extended interview about accessibility. Greg van der Heijden, it's great to have you back on the program after some years. Can we talk about the Trace Center, first of all, what it is, and a little bit about its history?
Okay, well, the Trace Center is a research and development center here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And it's been around for about just over 30 years now. It started out in the area of augmentative communication. Back then, we hadn't yet coined the term augmentative communication. That came out of a chapter I wrote in the mid-late 70s. But it was working on devices for individuals who could not speak or write. And later also we added computer access, but that wasn't as a primary. We didn't have personal computers back when all this began. The center started out working on augmentative communication. And if you look at it in 10-year chunks, so you talk about the 70s, we were working mostly on providing people with the means to communicate, speak and write. The AutoCom developed a lot of the early collections of information about it, a workshop series. A lot of the terms, scanning, direct selection, encoding, et cetera, came from early summary work we had done. The 1980s were really focused on computer access. And what we saw is that a lot of people were beginning to use these personal computers to do special things. And they would make talking word processors and things like this. The concern we had was that the computers were not being actually built by these companies for people with disabilities. They were being designed for lots of other purposes. And although they were really great as a tool to build special devices for people who had disabilities, we were really worried that computers were going to end up being in the classroom and workplace and everywhere else. And if people with disabilities couldn't use the standard software, that they were going to be in trouble, and that there wasn't always going to be special software to match all the standard, etc. So we began to refocus our efforts and work on what we then called transparent communication, and that is the transparent access, which is the ability to use a computer in a way that you can't tell that it's being used. And again, a lot of our early work was on in physical disabilities and allowing people to be able to use it in such a way that it looked like you were using the keyboard and the mouse, even though you might be just sipping and puffing or using eye gaze or whatever other technique you were physically able to use. We in the blindness area, we mostly were just working with others. We helped to try to get I worked with Apple in getting the Close View into their operating system. At the same time, we got the physical disability access in there. To give enlargement as a built-in part. And then we began really trying to encourage more research into graphic user interfaces because, again, the concern we saw was that this was something that was coming on and was likely to be compelling enough for people who weren't blind that it eventually would take over. And if we didn't have really good solutions in the blindness community. And again, mostly what we tried to do there was just to work with and encourage work by people who are already doing screen readers. We held a meeting in in Madison at one point to bring together the mostly the people who are doing the basically the DOS screen readers with Berkeley Systems, which at that time had done a screen reader for the Macintosh. And it was a good, but it was an interesting meeting. And the hardest part was when you're looking at things that will just make things harder for a group to talk about how you'd make it accessibility. When I would go talk to the National Federation of the Blind meetings and talk to them about graphic user interfaces, it was, of course, not a very, very popular topic when the whole world was DOS. But it was really very good because it helped to get a dialogue going, and we just learned so much by sitting and talking about how and why DOS and what might work for the graphic user interfaces, and just to begin moving things in those directions. Then what we saw was a lot of rolling out of technology in public places. And so in the 90s, a lot of the work we were focusing on was on basically information technologies, and the web began to pick up toward the end. And how do we make public information technologies so that they can be used without assistive technology? Now, when you have something that you have to really be efficient on, you very often need to have an assistive technology, something you really know and use and can operate efficiently. And so the need for, say, a screen reader or something that you know how to use as your access primary access tool to systems on your workstation is very important. Having every company decide how it was going to build voice access in a different way would be a problem. But when you're out and you come up to an ATM, or you come to a fare machine, or you come up to a building directory, you usually don't have your screen reader with you. They don't allow you to put your own software into the ATMs. And so we were looking at ways that you could build accessibility directly into public information systems and appliances and things like this. Interestingly, I noticed one of your topics later we'll come to is V2, where we will soon have the ability to bring assistive technology back into public products, but I'll leave that for later.
All right, there's a diverse range of things. Can I just ask you, while it's in my head to ask you this, can you give me your assessment as to the state of Windows access in your view? Obviously, Windows is the dominant operating system at the moment. Do you think that the access that blind people now have is satisfactory?
Oh, I don't think that the access that people who are blind have will ever be satisfactory to a system which is inherently a visual metaphor reinterpreted. I think the first time that we will have satisfactory access is when and we're starting to get there, is when the individual who's blind is using an auditory interface to access the underlying functionality. Already, as you know, screen readers don't read screens. And when you are using a screen reader, for example, to access web pages, they, quote, screen readers actually access the underlying information and the document object model and represent the information in much more efficient ways. So we're beginning to get there. But, no, as long as individuals who are blind are having to interface with software by having a piece of software which has to interpret a visual interface back into an auditory, it's going to be, it may be usable, it may be satisfactory, if you will, but it will be far from optimum.
One of the discussions that I've had with people over the years is this question of whether the operating system in and of itself ought not to be accessible? For example, should Microsoft make its operating system speech-friendly with a full-fledged screen reader out of the box so that no one has to buy third-party screen readers?
Oh, boy. There is a question with hand grenades all around on it. The answer is both yes and no. The danger that you have is if and when we have computers that are meant to be efficiently accessed in a purely auditory fashion, and there is a large main customer base doing that purely auditorily, and I'm not sure if that would ever happen except if one were blind, except in, you know, sort of off times, you know, you're driving your car, you want to interact with your information, etc. Then you might see it, and you might see enough time spent by a company to create a really effective auditory interface. Already companies, for all of the time and money that Microsoft and Apple and everybody else has spent trying to create a visual interface, the visual interfaces still have a long way to go. So if you have a portion of your customer base which is much, much smaller than your core, and you have a lot to go there, the amount of time and effort that would be expended and the quality of interface that you could build and would build for purely auditory access would be limited. And so what we have found to date is that companies that specialize in making screen readers and in auditory access software have been able to make better overall tools for individuals who are blind than a company that was doing it on the side. So I would hate to see that there just is whatever. Let me do this two ways. If Microsoft were to build a screen reader in, the market would come out from under a lot of the other screen reader manufacturers to the point that they may have difficulty expending the time they now do. And so the great fear is that what you'd end up with is, instead of having very expensive, very good screen readers, you would have free, not very good screen readers. Well, okay, so this gives everybody access to it and nobody has to pay more for it, and that's great. But the question is, if you need that better access in order to be competitive on the job, what do you do if there's no base for the better, the really good screen readers, which the people need in order to be competitive? Then basically what you've done is to give everybody access to a free screen reader, but you've left people without the really good ones that they need to keep the jobs, to compete, to really be at the top of the field. And so that's a real scary proposition. The flip over on the other side is that when we have public systems, and for all the people who can't afford the really expensive, what do we do there? And so perhaps the answer is that not to build a screen reader into the operating system, but rather to make it voice software friendly. That is, expose lots of information so it's easier to write screen readers, to have this voice technology there, which is happening on all computers, so that people don't have to go buy a hardware voice synthesizer. That's a big chunk of change right there gone. And enhance the ability of the operating system to allow people to use their own interfaces, be they auditory or, for individuals with cognitive disabilities, simpler, et cetera, to be able to access and use the product. So I guess I would rather see it easier and easier to make screen readers than it would be to and for them to work as the systems operate than it would be to see if we couldn't build a bottom level sort of least common denominator screen reader in as a part of the operating system. If it wasn't really good, it could actually end up being really bad in terms of its impact.
Given the social economic status of blind people, though, there must be a huge untapped market where the cost of a screen reader is a significant barrier to entry right now. And I wonder whether you could draw a parallel between, for example, picking one, that Windows XP offers basic CD writing support, but people still go out and buy Nero and Easy CD Creator because of the additional power that those packages offer.
Well, here's an interesting dynamic. And let me first sort of answer, give a bottom line and then loop back a little bit as to some of the rationale. I think that the way of doing that might be to have there be good, less expensive screen readers, as well as even better, more expensive. I'm worried. And then there could be some essentially free fundamental ones, and there generally tend to be. At least in the DOS world, it was a lot easier. In the graphic world, it got to be so hard since before you ever got around to making the user interface, you just had so much code just trying to eke out, work out the get the information out of the operating system. If one were to put even a simple screen reader into the operating system, and you call it a screen reader, a lot of companies and a lot of other places would say, well, there's already a screen reader. We already gave you one. Schools, programs, all sorts of places that currently will buy a screen reader, and then while they're at it, they will end up getting one that's halfway decent, would suddenly not get even into evaluating screen readers because there was one already there. If that happened, then suddenly you might find that the number of screen readers, the total number of volumes, drops to such a small number that there isn't a big enough market left to pay for the R&D. The reason that you still can do what you were talking about with the CD programmers or writers is that it's such a huge market that even if you give half of it away, it still is so big that there's a lot of money to be made by selling to the rest of the people. You can actually sell something that just has a better interface. And the prices of those things are low enough that they make it up for volume. When you have something like a screen reader where it's not $29.95 or $49.95, but you're talking about something which is, you know, $1,000, that's a lot sort of tougher sell because people say, well, there's this basic one built in and we'll just make do with that. And then if the person doesn't work as well, well, that's okay. We'll let them get away with it. Well, you, quote, let them get away with just sitting tight in the job they are and not advancing because they're not going to be the ones you turn to when you need to get something done because they just can't get it done. But you don't really put the two and two together that that's because you didn't really give them the tools they needed or because the tools aren't available anymore because there weren't enough people buying it. So it's a tough one. Now, maybe there'll be some light at the end of the tunnel in that as operating systems get better, as operating systems expose their information more, both for accessibility and for other reasons, user agents, intelligent agents. And let me make a note to later talk about agent access. So if I forget that, you hit me with that.
Okay.
But if we do that, then it may be that the cost that won't be so expensive to build and maintain and improve these screen readers, and the price can come down, and the number sold can go up, and it can still be a viable market.
You made the comment about the importance of the operating system vendors enabling better access for screen readers, and I suppose Microsoft Active Accessibility represents real progress in this regard, but it still seems to me that every time a third-party vendor, say Macromedia or Real Networks or whoever, MSAA enable their application, the screen reader vendors still have to go back and do their tweaking, so I'm not sure how much development time is actually being saved. I wonder whether you think that MSAA has turned out as well as we hoped it might.
Well, I think if you ask the community and the people working with software and trying to interface with MSAA, MSAA was revolutionary, and it was a huge advance from where we were. MSAA, in some respects, suffers from being first in that, you know, you always have legacy. Once you do everything, you know, later if you went back, you said, you know, if we did this thing in another way, we could have done it better, but, you know, you can't just sort of stop in the middle and say, okay, everybody, go back and do everything you did all over again. We're going to restructure. There's a lot of things that MSAA doesn't do or doesn't do as well as we'd like it to do today. Microsoft is continuing to try to improve it. There's other models being used that in other areas. So I would say that MSAA was a huge advance and a revolution in its and you know the first thing like it. It really stepped forward, and especially on the platform that it was on, which was so widespread, it was a huge impact. But it has shortcomings, and it has a lot of things that could be better, that people would like to be better. And, yeah, there's still tweaking that needs to be done. There's tweaking that needs to be done on basically all the systems every time we upgrade them. There's a group that's been trying to, Microsoft and Sun and others have gotten together, and they're trying to work with the AT industry. The ATIA has got the AT Industry of America, Assistive Technology Industry Association, I should say, is a group that's working on interoperability. But it's very hard to talk about interoperability across platforms because the platforms, the code base is so different. You can't have one API that works across. It's a really tough problem. But there are people working on it. We just all wish it was an easier problem and we could get more done faster.
We're about to begin quite a major series that's going to run at least over the month of May and possibly longer on access to the GNOME interface or operating system. I'm not terribly familiar with work that's being done and I'm looking forward to the series myself on that, but I wonder whether you've kept up with the play there and what you think of that solution as it develops.
Again, what we have is something that's coming along later, and so it has a number of advantages and advances. It also has as soon as you get into the open environment, you also have a lot of new challenges that you have to deal with. There is an advantage to having complete control over something, and there's also a disadvantage to it. There are great advantages to the open source, and in terms of trying to capture in a nutshell, I would say that you are going to be seeing some very interesting discussions, very interesting advances. You'll get, I'm sure, a description of the difference between the approaches that we're now able to take from earlier ones in terms of the architecture, etc. It's very exciting to see this type of accessibility being addressed on a platform that works with multiple operating systems. There's a chicken and egg kind of issue, too, in terms of if there isn't a big enough market, then will there really be the screen readers? Do we go with, you know, open source kind of things? But then will we see the dedication and support necessary? It's a really sort of tricky, very complex interaction between IT and AT and open source community in terms of trying to address this. The GNOME effort is has some nice pieces to it from the standpoint that it's being backed by a major IT a company that is using it within its product line, so it has some constraints on it. But as soon as that happens, of course, then some people say, oh, you know, we want something that's completely free and of you know, any one corporation. And so it's interesting. As Sun has been trying to both back it and to make sure that it really comes through and delivers, because they want to have accessibility on their platforms, yet they're trying to not get too close so that you actually, you know, sort of quash the atmosphere of the open source.
Yeah.
I will let the group who will be talking about it go into greater detail. And as we're talking, I'm trying to figure out how to answer your question without spending disappearing into a 20-minute discussion as we go down and into the depth of some of the aspects. But some of the comments I'm making will make more sense, I think, in the, when they talk about the details about what it's doing and how it's being structured.
All right. The Apple, when I started using computers in the early 1980s, everybody was using Apple IIes and II pluses pretty much. We don't hear too much about access to the Apple in the context of totally blind people using them. To the best of my knowledge, there's only one screen reader still, and that's outspoken for the Mac. What's your assessment of the accessibility of Apple operating systems?
For individuals who are blind?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. The well, this is the classic problem of the chicken and the egg. The most people who were blind, and most companies, were in the PC platform, and so that's where the largest market is, and so that's where you find all of the screen readers. When you have something like the Apple, and again, one of the big markets for the Apple has been in graphics and layout and stuff, which is not exactly the profession that individuals who are blind would head toward. So the question is there a large enough base of users who are blind of Apples to provide the funding base of customers to provide for a very vibrant and a profitable market for screen readers? And if there isn't, then you won't have a lot of screen reader vendors vying for it. Why spend all that time for a few when you could spend it for many? So there was, and for a while there, some of us were very afraid that if Outspoken was felt that it just wasn't a big enough market, it wasn't enough work to keep up with Outspoken, that in fact we could have none, and you know, that would really be terrible. But basically that's the issue and the problem. Apple's very concerned about it, and as you know, they were the first company to actually build accessibility features into their products, including the enlargement software, which was built into their system. Software as well as sticky keys and mouse keys from Trace and other modifications. And the Outspoken, they worked with close view code in the original Apples came from the same company that made Outspoken. Although the Outspoken software itself was all written externally before they got the internal context within Apple. So Apple's very concerned about it, and they're doing, you know, everything they can to try to make sure that that there remains a good, robust set of accessibility tools for their computer.
Before we move off the whole topic of software for desktop PCs, can we come back to the concept of user agents that you were going to talk about?
Not user agents, agent access.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is intelligent agent. Right now, when you want to get a file from your computer, you will typically go over and you will go to a, on a Macintosh, it would be a Finder and in the Windows, it's Explorer, not Internet Explorer, but Windows Explorer.
Mm-hmm.
And you then start digging through hierarchies to find your files and or do a search command, etc. In the future, we're going to be seeing that we will more and more be returning to agents. And so we will come up to it, and whether we talk or type or braille, we will give a command. And the command may be something like, find the file or give me the file or open the file that I did at the Gerund Technology Conference on, regarding voting. And, poof, up it'll come. Now, to do that, it has to be able to understand what it is you're talking about, and the agent has got to be able to operate the program. I'm going to be able to load a program onto my computer and say, open my word processor and... title, blah, 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 oh, center that and make it bold. And it's going to have to figure out how to do that with a program that it doesn't know about. And to do that, the commands are not going to be just icons. They're going to have to be there. They're going to have to be semantically coded. That means that meaning is going to have to be attached to them so that bold doesn't just show up as, you know, a little icon with a dark letter. It's going to have to be, in this case, bold, but if I say center that, but if I say put it in the middle, it's going to have to be able to say middle. What is middle? Look around, find out that there's a command called center, and it can't find one called middle, so put it in the middle, and it, you know, using algorithms would determine that that is the equivalent of center, and so it would execute the center command. That means that the software, the commands, the command structure, the menus are going to have to be semantically understandable without you having to see them. The devices are not very good at seeing. When machines are able to see, and so you could give it a command, then they also could present that information in text form. Now, I want to step back a bit here for a second. I want to, first of all, credit Doug Wakefield and Judy Dixon. There has been a conundrum that we've been sort of following in this field for a long time, and no one had really gotten their arms around it. And the two of them on a weekend did. And so let me say what it is. We keep saying that everything should be accessible from the keyboard. And we say that you should be able to do everything from the keyboard you can do with a mouse so that people who are blind are not inadvertently prevented from doing something they should be able to do simply because somebody decided the interface was going to be a visual interface even though the task was not. For example, make this bold or center this or do something like that. Or even turn up the volume, where the only way to do it would be to grab a mouse and go up and find a little thing that's sticking up on a long line with a short line and grab the short line and drag it along the long line, and the volume goes up. And anybody who can see recognizes it as a volume control, but without any semantic tagging on it, it's a graphic. There's no way of determining what it is or how to use it. And on the other hand, there are some things like finger painting or watercolors, where you just, there isn't any way of doing watercolors if you can't see. There's nothing, you know, it's a pure visual activity. And so how do you make a rule that separates those things which like that volume control, which were unnecessarily made graphic, from things which are so inherently visual that it's silly to say that they have to be operable from the keyboard, because you just can't do that. And Doug and Judy were wrestling a bit with this, and they came up with a phrase, which is anything where the action or the result can be explained in words. And then later it was changed to be explained concisely in words, or without a lot of words. Should be operable from the keyboard, or I will say should be operable from verbally or using words. I don't mean speech, it can be typed or braille. So if we use that distinction, we suddenly find that there are some things that are pure visual fall outside. But if everything else about the operating system that can be expressed in words, or the result can be expressed in words, could be then made available, we can begin to have interfaces where agents, as well as screen readers, etc., could be able to access it. I wrote a book about a chapter a year ago where I actually posited that if anything that is machine accessible is accessible, and if it's not machine accessible, it's not. And if a machine, the flip is not necessarily true. But if we made everything machine accessible, that would be sufficient, because it then means that the machine could represent it in a form which was appropriate to the user. If the machine could perceive it, operate it, and understand it. And, of course, machines are getting better and better at that over time. So if we have that, and if everybody who's lazy, let's leave people who are blind aside for a second, if everybody who is just lazy or wants to be efficient could interact with their information systems by just communicating, talking, gesturing, a whole rich form of ways of doing it. But if one of the ways was that they could just communicate, either talking or writing, what it is they wanted it to do, and they could do it, and it would present the information back to them in verbal form. It could also be visual, but it could be verbal. Then we would have a system which could be used by individuals even who are deafblind. And so this is something that I see us as a society heading toward, not in order to make things accessible, but in order to make it easier and faster for us to allow our computers to do things for us. And as we do that, we will make it so that individuals who are blind will have more and more and more access, because they will simply use a different interface than we would. Now, sometimes we visually may be more efficient. For example, I can have something presented to me, and I can instantly see a huge array of information in parallel that you can't do visually, and even tactically you can't. So there is still that bandwidth issue. But in terms of what can be done and having access to it, and the individual who's blind would then just be more precise about their question, so they don't get a big array of stuff and then they visually look for it, they would be more precise, so they got a small set that was what they were looking for. It would be, for example, a blind individual would do a better search and get five things they would look at, whereas somebody who is visual might do a sloppier search, because if they get 25, it doesn't matter, they then do a visual.
This is interesting, because what it seems to be saying is that it's all about outcomes, it's all about ends rather than means. And you get people who frown upon what they call, quote, closed systems, unquote, systems designed for the blind with proprietary user interfaces. And there is a school of thought out there that says that if anybody's offering a product that does something the Windows way, that's more open, it's more accepted in society, and therefore it's got to be better.
Yeah. Let me put a bookmark here and jump you to another topic area that I know you want to get to, because it relates, but we have to talk about it first.
Okay.
And that's the V2,
right,
and the AIAP and the Universal Remote Consoles. So everybody, just blank slate, erase your your desktops, your
delete star dot star,
your tablets.
Yeah.
Yeah, delete star.
Don't try this at home. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. What if we could create a standard, a mechanism that would allow you to control any device, any place, from any device? So I could use, and let's walk away from disability, because this won't happen unless it can happen for reasons other than disability, and then we'll come back. So let's say we just have something that you can grab a PDA or a cell phone, and you could both read the thermostat upstairs and set it to the temperature you want. Then you could check the timer on the stove. You could set it for a little longer. You could check, program the VCR to record something, and you could also tune the stereo to a channel you're interested in. And you're still lying in bed. You then decide that you are going to have to get up an hour earlier tomorrow morning, so you set the alarm clock, and you also set the coffee pot to turn on an hour earlier, so that when you actually get to the kitchen at that bleary hour of the morning, you actually can pour a little coffee into your bloodstream, or dilute the blood in your coffee stream, however you want to think about it. Well, you also can, because of the agent, do all of those things without actually picking anything up. You simply turn to, or you just speak to a microphone in the wall, or you speak to a thing in your pocket, doesn't really matter, and you say, what's the temperature? And it tells you, and you say, well, set the thermostat down to 2 degrees. And forgot what the second thing I did. Oh, yeah, check the oven. How much time is left? Okay, put an extra 10 minutes on that, and set the alarm clock for an hour to 6:30, and set the coffee pot to turn on at 6:30, and record what's on channel 14 at 10 o'clock, and also record the Sopranos whenever it comes on. I don't remember that anymore. And would you put on Beethoven's Fifth? And it does it all, and it does it all without any of those things that you talked about having any intelligence at all. The only thing that's got any intelligence is the thing in your pocket, the thing that you're talking to. And what it does is, when you said, you know, what is the temperature, it basically said, what's there? And so it looks around and it finds anything that has temperature. And if it only finds some things, if you say, what's the temperature in here, it has a certain amount of heuristics. It also has things on the network it can go up to. If it doesn't know how to process something, it can get some hints from the network. It finds out there's a thermostat. It finds out there's a display. It finds out there's a temperature. And so it says back to you, the thermostat reads, you know, 74 degrees. And then you say, well, can you make it 2 degrees cooler? It checks and it finds out, you know, where the closest thermostat is, or the thermostat that controls where you are, and it sets it down 2 degrees, and et cetera. As you give commands, it just looks for devices around that it looks like could deal with that command. If you said record and you got three recorders, it would say, you know, what do you want to be recorded on? And it would name the three things, and you'd tell it. That standard is what we call the Universal Remote Console standard. It's being worked on by the V2 Technical Committee at the International Committee on Information Technology Standards, which is INCITS. Now, we've been pursuing this Universal Remote Console dream for many years, but with the advance of the new technologies, the networking, and this, by the way, this new standard is built entirely on top of existing standards. So it uses the same protocols as you're using on the internet, UPnP and the Microsoft side, and Java Genie on the Sun side. So it's not anything that does differently from what people do now. In other words, if it's done now, it just rides on top of that. It's just, what is it that you say over these technologies, et cetera? It would require that each device provide what we'll call a virtual abstract interface, which is basically a place that you can get to electronically that will tell you, you know, what the things it can do are and what the requirements are. For example, if you go up to an ATM and you say, give me $50, the device would go to look around and say, is there something around here who can, you know, give bucks or checks up the slang and gets, you know, dollars, and it's $50, and there's an ATM, and it has something called withdrawal. That sounds like that'll match with give me, but it won't do that unless you meet the following requirements. You need to, A, say who you are. B, you need to authenticate that you are that person. C, you have to give an amount of money in $20 bills. And D, you got to tell it what account to take it from. So if I walk up and I say, give me $50, it would look around, it would come back, and it knows who you are. It can authenticate you. $50 doesn't meet this, and so it would say, there's an ATM you need to give, and it can only give denominations of $20, and I need to know what account. So you say, okay, make it $60 for my checking. And it gives it to you. But it says, so you want to withdraw $60 from your checking account. You say yes, and it gives it to you. Next time you walk up to the ATM, you're a little smarter, and you say, give me $60 for my checking, and it gives you $60, and you walk away. And you didn't have to do anything. You just walked up, said, give me $60 for my checking, and your device knew who you are. It may say, authenticate yourself so that if you told your device that you don't want it to ever authenticate you unless you do something, so someone can't steal your PDA and go around taking your money out. Maybe it's actually monitoring your body at the same time, so it knows it's you. But that kind of capability, well, as soon as you have that kind of capability, now you have the ability for someone who's blind to be able to go up, and they can do it with voice. They can do it in Braille. Somebody who's deaf-blind could do it in Braille. Somebody with a cognitive disability could do it and interact in symbols. But the device only knows that something interacted with it in its own language, if you will, on this virtual interface. Now, for VCRs, the standard also allows the company to deliver a very custom, beautiful, sculpted visual interface that works perfectly on any Palm or any pocket PC, so that it can be wonderful and have a beautiful visual experience for someone who's sighted, because that's what they want to do. But it would also still have this virtual interface, which would allow people anywhere who had permission to be able to access and use it. So actually, I could be at the office and say, I promised Jimmy I'd record that show for him. And so I could log on with permission, get through to my system, and program it to do what it needed to do. So this idea, and I just did it on appliance level, one of the questions we're having right now is how far can we go with this? Could we have it that the person would be able to interact with their computer in the same fashion? And again, it won't happen except if it's really powerful and really interesting to people who don't have disabilities, because otherwise it's not going to get built in. But it is, and it is for the same reasons as you just heard. People would love to have it. I haven't described this yet to anybody with or without a disability, and the most important part is all the people without disability who haven't just said, oh, yeah, when can I get it?
You've had this dream for a long time, and now the...
I, and, I and others.
Yeah, and the technology is now catching up with that vision. How long do you think, and I know people hate these questions, how long do you think it will be before in reality people can have this kind of interface to work with between their appliances and whatever method of communication they choose to use?
Well, we're shooting for a draft standard in December 2004, which is like 18 months away. And the actually worked out a bootstrap method, so there's actually a way of implementing the standard on products after you that came out before the standard. I won't try to go into it now, but as long as there's a machine interface on the product, we can build the standard into how do you say this? The standard is actually a way of communicating how to interact with that device in a standard way. If the device has a way to interact with it built in, we can add the how to do it later. And if you go to a device and it can't tell you, then you could go to the manufacturer's site, for example, and get it there, or get it from a third site. So I would say that it could be just a matter of years. Now, you would have to buy products that supported this, but it... again, it wouldn't have to be any particular brand, and we're working very carefully to make sure that this is not technology specific. That is, you don't have to buy all of your products from one company or even one technology in order to get this to work. You could actually be using a wide mixture of products.
So it wouldn't require, for example, you to have a local area network in your home or anything like that?
Yes and no. It would require that you have some path between the thing you are using to control it and the thing that is being controlled. That could be, infrared. Typically, we're talking about some kind of network, but they're now talking about networks that would actually go right through the electrical plugs. So basically, when you plugged everything into the wall, it would all be connected, because they would just communicate over the electrical wiring.
Right.
There's actually some... there's a big push from one major company to distribute internet access to the home through the power wires to the home. So it's a very interesting world. Once in the home, it could be wired, or it could be wireless, or it could travel through the wires, or it could go partway through the air and the rest of the way through the wires. That part of it, we're finding the home networking part is advancing very, very rapidly, and it may be the least expensive part of everything we're doing.
So in terms of the input side, do you think that speech recognition and, I guess for want of a better term, artificial intelligence is advancing to such a point that such portable devices to which you can give these instructions can be manufactured soon?
Yes. Let me give a couple of data points on that. First, it doesn't have to be done that way. It could be done where you grab a device and it talks to you, and you just do it through a hierarchical menu. What are the devices? Pick the device. What are the choices? Pick the choice. And it could all be done through speech. And you will sometimes want to do it that way. For example, when you're sitting there watching a movie and you want to turn the volume up, you don't want to say, could you turn the volume up a little bit more? What you want to do is reach down and grab something and find TV, hit it, find volume, and move it up silently. So there will be times when you want to do it. Or you'll just type it in. You just reach down and type, or Braille. You'll have new Braille stylus on the tip, or you'll have different ways of entering commands, so that you don't have to talk out loud. In terms of speech, IBM is actually working on something they call superhuman speech recognition, which means that it actually would recognize speech better than humans. And because again of the demand for this, not in the disability but in other areas, that is advancing very rapidly as well. And I don't know, and if I knew, I couldn't tell you, when and where they will that will reach what levels. We do have language recognition, again, proceeding. And as long as you're doing things in what I would call constrained grammars or constrained contexts. If you're sitting there and it knows it's going to get a command and it's got to operate something, and by looking around it knows all of the things that the things around you can do, and it only has to try and do a best fit, that's a lot different than trying to just randomly understand language on any topic at any time, which is, you know, another goal that's going after. There's also just tremendous advances in computing power. We have just recently gotten to the point for $1,000 you could buy a computer that had the computing power of a dragonfly. But I think it's 2 or 3 years, I have to go check, we will, for $1,000, be able to buy the computing power of a mouse. By 2024, I believe it is, 22 or 24, $1,000 will buy you the computing power of the human brain.
Is this according to Moore's Law?
This is this is Moore's Law. This
yeah.
is, actually, you can find a really nice chart of this. Unfortunately, it's a pure graphic, but it's also discussed in text on Kurzweil AI, www.kurzweil.com. KurzweilAI.com. And but the interesting thing is by 2044, for $1,000 you'll be able to buy the computing power of 20 billion brains, everybody on the planet. So, you know, what are we going to do with that computing power? And will we actually learn how to write programs that can do something meaningful with it? So the computing power, the size, you know, we know is going the other direction as fast as the computing power is going up. Language, intelligence are all heading. So, you know, we're already working on projects to do some simple heuristics for speech control of things. And I think that, again, doing this, and this can be done, we talked about open platform before. The way the standard's being developed, the resources that you draw on to help you do these inferences can actually be out on the network. And so people can be constantly developing better algorithms that can then be used to help do these kinds of things. So it's I don't think it will be that long before you can give commands, especially if you give fairly well-behaved ones. Don't say, give me $50. Just say, you know, I would like to withdraw $50. And that's not very hard to work with.
It's fascinating. The question that we get a lot of email about relates to cell phone access. I guess appliance access generally is a biggie, and then cell phone access is the biggest subset of that, if you will. How do you envisage this working in a cell phone context, where now short messaging and all kinds of sort of WAP features are coming onto cell phones that we're being shut out of at the moment as blind people?
Well, that's actually two topics. If we say we want to have cell phone access because we want to make phone calls, that should be fairly straightforward, especially today. I mean, you can buy cards for $4 that talk, and the cards that don't talk, that are just paper, are $3, and the cards with paper that have a little fuzz on them are $3.50. So, and as we're talking, I will see if I can both talk and bring up a sound effect, which is actually the audio from one of these cards. And we're doing some work now on a what we call model, a reference design phone that would show you how you could provide complete access, including the battery and the roaming indicator and the signal strength in a very efficient and auditory way, along with the phone functionality. So I think you'll be seeing that coming, and as we get some good designs and get good feedback and make even better designs, there isn't any reason that can't be done fairly straightforwardly. After all, the cell phone is nothing but an audio processing machine full of all of the chips that it takes to do audio processing. And if walking to the static menus and stuff is a problem, that's pretty easy. The second part of your question says, but now we're getting SMS and messaging and all the other kinds of things. And so now you're saying, well, in addition to the phone, I'd like to also have access to all of the basically PDA and information appliance functionality. Again, that can be done fairly straightforwardly, and I don't think it will be a long time before you see it. There's two barriers there. One is, unlike the menus where you can just digitize speech and have it read back, with short messaging service, you've actually got to have text to speech. But again, I think we are going to see that, and the power of the machines, the speed of the machines is going up. People are going to want to have their messages read to them because, God forbid, they're going to try to use them while they're driving their car, and I hope they have them read to them and not trying to sit there driving down the road holding it at arm's length because they don't have their reading glasses on trying to read the message. And so just for safety reasons, we may see this becomes a popular feature. The tricky part will be that they probably will have it so it will read the SMS messages, but it won't read a bunch of the other things. What it'll do is somebody will decide, oh, the things that somebody would want to do while they're driving are the following, and they will make it so that it will do those things in voice, but then they will forget to do the rest because they will forget that there are some people who don't see or can't use their vision all of the time, and not just when they're driving cars. So part of it is going to be an information and an education process, but it will be enabled by the fact that the technology will be possible, and companies in their ever-ending quest to add a feature that might differentiate their product from somebody else's, I think will begin implementing these. Good examples and good advice. Anybody who has ideas for how things should work so that they will really work well for blind people, not for sighted people who are trying to think what it would be nice for a blind person, these are going to be really important to making sure that people who really want to do things, not just for sighted people driving cars, but also for blind people, know what it is that really is the way to do that. And sometimes it's obvious and sometimes it is not.
You make the comment that the cell phone is an audio processing tool, and that's absolutely right. Why is it taking so long, do you think, for cell phone providers or manufacturers to put in these basic features, even for navigating of menus and things?
The cell phone business is a very cutthroat business, and so let me take just a couple of minutes to tell a story that came to me from. It was a vice president of a very large IT company, but not one that you are thinking of. But I was sitting with him, and it was 25 years ago. So I can that eliminates some IT companies because they weren't around 25 years ago.
Yes.
And we were talking about accessibility for different disabilities. And the person said, he said, this is really amazing. He said, I just really never even thought that people with disabilities used our products. It just never occurred to me. And it never occurred to me that people who are blind would have a different problem than people who are deaf. I mean, it's obvious, he said, but it's just that I never even thought about either one of them, so I never thought about the fact they would be different. He said, this is really good. He said, I have to tell you that when I came in here, I come in with meetings every now and then to meet with people who want to talk to us about these kinds of things. And I knew that when I left here, I would take all the materials you give me and I would drop them in my wastebasket on the way back to my desk. He said, but I really... You just ought to know, I really think that this is something that we ought to be trying to do. You should also know that we just spent $1 million getting rid of a dollar and a quarter part. And so if accessibility means we got to add a connector or something like this, then you know, I'm not sure you're going to find it very easy going. But he said, why don't you pass a law that says we need to do this? And I just stared at him, and I just said, what did you say? And he said, why don't you pass a law that says we have to do this? And I said, I never expected to hear the vice president of a major IT company say something like that. Mm. And he said, I'll tell you what. He said, I really think this is really important. And so I'm not going to drop it in my wastebasket. I'm going to put it on my desk. I'm not even going to put it on my credenza. But I'll set it on my desk, and it'll be one of those things I think really we need to work on. But also on my desk are going to be four piles, and or five piles. And two of them will be smoking, and one of them will be on fire. And so I'll put out the fire, and one of the other smokers will burst into flame. And so I'll be putting that out, and then my secretary will bring in three more piles, one of which is smoking, at least. And sometimes one of them is already on flame. And by the time I go home tonight, I hope the flames will be out, but I know when I get back in the morning, another smoker will be in flames. And a year from now, I will come back, and I'll still be putting out smokers and flamers, and yours will still be sitting on the corner of my pile, on the corner of my desk, and I'll still think it's really important to do, but I'll still be stamping out smokers and flamers. He said, if you pass a law that says we have to do it, two things happen. He says, first of all, I don't have to worry that while I'm busy doing something on this, my competitor is doing something that else that gives him an advantage. The second is that your pile will begin to smoke. So the reason that I'll tell you one more story, and that is that we were at a major conference, and one of the people reporting was talking about a place where they had passed some accessibility laws and they had fines, and the companies looked at it and decided that it was more work to keep track of the accessibility laws and compliance than it was just to pay the fines.
Yes.
And so they just paid the fines. And in fact, they didn't even put it in their compliance section. They put it over in their section that paid the building fees. And they just treated it as a fee. And they just paid it. And even if they built an accessible building, they still paid it.
Mm-hmm.
What it amounts to is that all of our lives are filled with piles that are smoking and flaming. And everybody is trying to put those out. The cell phone industry is very, very competitive. You're really worried about what you're doing and what the next person is doing. And you're worried about these flamers and these smokers. And they've been going through hard times. And they're, you know, a lot of times just trying to keep themselves together, keep their divisions together, not lose their jobs. And so if they have the focus, and I know a number of people who are working very hard in the companies to try to get accessibility into phones. But at the same time, they're still trying to make sure that they're still around next year selling phones at all, because it won't do any good to make accessible phones if they're out of business. And so they're so busy trying to put out smokers and flamers that accessibility is one of these things that's really important, and they're really trying to work on it, and they're making progress, but it just isn't making the progress that we would like to see, because it's got to get in line behind a bunch of other smokers and flamers, one of which is staying in business.
And yet Section 255 of the Telecommunications Act should be turning this issue into a smoker, should it not? And if it's not, is the FCC doing its job?
Well, it's the way the law was written. It says that you need to do it if it can be done with little effort or expense. And if you don't do it, that what you do is you complain to the FCC, and then the FCC will talk to the company. But there's really no what's called right of private action. So there's no there's nobody that you can really sue or nothing. It's not a very strong law in terms of enforcement or giving people the ability to do much. Having said that, I will say that actually I believe that's the proper way that we should begin, is with laws that say what should be done, but that don't get too strong up front and give industry a chance to move and to act and to respond. And if they do, then there isn't the need to do the draconian, because sometimes when you start having really strong things, companies get so defensive, because they have to. It turns out that legally there's reasons why you have to, that it actually gets in the way of doing things. So what we need to do is to be sure that we do this in a way that that allows companies to be able to respond. Now, they haven't as well on this as one would hoped, but on the other hand, nobody has actually complained. I think the first complaint to the FCC was just filed this year. So of all the people who are blind who can't use cell phones, no one's actually been complaining.
Right.
The FCC hasn't heard from anybody. And so it's really hard for the FCC to say, you guys have to really do this, you're not doing your job, when there aren't any complaints coming in. Now, I know part of that is because people get so used to not being able to use anything that they just sort of say, yeah, I know, that's same old, it's life as usual, it's not anything different than I'm used to. But it's really hard to yell at the FCC about not acting when, in fact, no one's actually been complaining.
If a standard commercial vendor, manufacturer of cell phones, produces a fairly usable product, does that not also give it the 508 advantage and therefore increase government purchasing potentially?
Yeah, actually, 508 is... Now, it's interesting, there's push legislation and pull legislation. Push says, you have to do this. Pull says, if you do this, I will buy your product. Pull is always better because it works through all the natural marketing forces of the company. And 508 is pull. Now, basically the government is pushed into requiring or asking for accessible products. And there is a right of private action there. If you don't do it, then you can bring a case against the government, not against the company. Companies don't have to do anything. But if the government then does, and they have been taking it seriously, and they show preference for products which are accessible, then yes, products which are accessible would have a market advantage. And the key to that is twofold. One is getting products which are really good and well designed, and that takes a lot of input to the companies and working with the disability community, so that you actually end up with things that are really going to be working well. And then the government being aware that they exist and being aware of what actually is good or makes things usable, and that can be very powerful. And so 508 has been much more effective. Again, because there was some teeth on the front end for the government, but because it was a pull legislation in terms of industry, and that is really, if you can get big companies, big customers, the government, states, even large companies, we're finding large companies saying, you know, we have a lot of employees who have disabilities. Is your stuff accessible? And that really surprises people when they say, well, you're not the government. And they say, so? I want to have accessible products, and these government regulations, this seems like a reasonable thing. Can you just answer my question? And that is extraordinarily powerful in terms that shows up in salesmen, that shows up in the marketing, and that goes into product requirements. And if anybody has the ability to affect purchasing by large companies, by large groups, and can just get them to bias them toward accessible things, it is just massively effective. And companies, it rewards companies with sales and profits for doing things that are more accessible. And that's really the way we'd like to see it work.
So are there any other legislative measures that you feel are necessary to promote a barrier-free society, or is the mix about right?
Oh, barrier-free society, barrier-free society. Well, we have legislation. we're getting a little bit into legal theory and legislative theory and stuff, and I want to be, I'm not sure that I know the best mix of social legislation. There are others that I would talk to first before I wandered very far in that direction. Probably the hardest part is the high technology areas, because if you don't say specifically what's required, it's very hard to tell industry what's required. On the other hand, if you say specifically what's required, it's going to look kind of silly pretty quick, because the technologies are advancing so fast. So what we've been trying to do, and I think the legislation you'll see, is to use general terms and then have come up with something which would be kind of like a common understanding of what's acceptable today. And then just as technologies advance, more and more can be done and more would be expected. If we can make it just really easy, but what I really think the best thing to do is to have accessibility laws that combine with figuring out how to have those things which are needed for accessibility be things which everybody who doesn't have a disability would find useful for other reasons. We have a cell phone, a reference design that we put together. And you take a cell phone and you add 6 mass market features. One of them is just a volume control that goes higher so that you can actually hear people talk when you're in a shopping mall when it's noisy. It has a feature called a babysitter feature where you just go to the menu, you choose the babysitter feature, you punch in a phone number, and then you punch in a lock code, and then you close the phone, you give it to your babysitter, and if you open it, it calls that number. And if anybody calls the phone, it doesn't ring unless they know the code. So you give this phone to the babysitter, and now they have a phone which you can call, and they pick it up, and it answers. And if they have a problem or the kid cracks his head, they just open it up. Doesn't matter that they're scared, they don't know what's going on, they haven't used your phone, and they don't know where the damn dial button is. They just open the phone and hold it to their ear. We have another feature that allows you to be sitting in a meeting or on this phone call as we're sitting here, and somebody wants to call, and I can't interrupt it, but I just push the silent feature, and so it buzzes. I flip it open, and whatever they say shows up on the screen, and I can sort of write something back, and it comes back to them as speech, and I close it, or you can have it done in different ways. And then you have a feature that allows the screen in to be with larger letters and things, so I don't have to put my reading glasses on to use my phone. And also I can walk the menus and have them talk, so that if I'm on my way to the airport and it starts buzzing with a message, I don't have to wait till I get to the airport to find out that I left my ticket on my desk. I can just take it and walk the menu, hold it up to my ear, and use the whole thing without ever looking at it. And by doing those features, I now have a phone that works for individuals who are hard of hearing, who are deaf, who are physical disabilities, who have low vision, who are blind, and all of those things are features that, when I describe them, everybody I talk to wants to get a phone that does that, because they all have use for those features. If we can figure out how to couch and then to make sure these things will really work well for us in these various constrained conditions, you know, then we can really get stuff, because now they can market these things. And so now they're all of a sudden afraid that someone's going to come out with that market before there's, and their phone market will dry up. And I'll tell you, that's a flaming pile on your desk if you ever saw one.
Mm. You don't think we're a big enough market in ourselves then to justify the addition of particular features, that we need to always look for synergies with the wider able-bodied community?
Yeah, and the reason I say that is several. First, count how many of you there are as compared to everything. Could you support, say, a blindness grocery store or a blindness record shop or a blindness? And the answer is, well, no, because there wouldn't be enough people in any one location. Well, when you want to buy a cell phone, you don't want to, first of all, the only cell phones that people know about are usually the ones that they see in advertisements or at the store. And so it doesn't matter that there might be enough people that you could sell those phones to. They will never find out about them because the information about that special phone won't get there. Now, Motorola, for example, or Nokia, or any one of those companies, may make like, you know, 10 different, 15 different phones. But when you go to the store, how many do you see? Three, maybe two from each company. And so is the blindness phone going to be one of those? No. So how many people who are blind are ever going to discover it? IBM made a keyboard for a key guard for individuals who had physical disabilities. It was a wonderful key guard. And they made them, but they never sold them because nobody ever found out about it. And whenever we would tell people about it, and then they would go to the dealers, none of the dealers knew about it, couldn't find it. And so we finally had to, whenever we told somebody about it, we had to give them the name of a person in IBM that you could call that we knew about how to order that keyboard. It's very hard to have a special product. And you also, by the way, would then need to pay for the same phone that I paid either a penny for because I did it with a deal, or if I didn't do the deal, I paid $300 for. You'd have to pay $600 or $800 for the same phone just because of the extra costs of having a very specialized line item that isn't one of the main sales items, that isn't going to be in all this, that, and you've got to do special, you know, blah, 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 et cetera. It's a very expensive. It costs a tremendous, it costs millions and millions of dollars to have a phone, another phone, in your list of products, even if you don't actually make the phone. I mean, just all of the costs and inventory and tracking and everything else. So, and then how long is the phone good for? You know, phones are maybe, they make them for what, six, 9 months, and they don't make the phone anymore? Desk phones? You know, these phones you buy on your desk, could you buy a Radio Shack? We found one that was really accessible, and we went back to the manufacturer to buy some more a year later, and he said, you know, we only make them once. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, we make a design, and then we make, like, you know, a million or units or something, and then we just throw away the molds, and we design a new one and you know, make that one. We actually don't ever manufacture the same phone, you know, for any period of time.
It's interesting we've kind of come full circle, which is good, because can we draw out the differences between your comments on screen readers earlier not being necessarily part of the operating system and this, because mightn't blind people be willing to pay a few extra $100 or whatever for a truly accessible device? In fact, I see that Alvar Access Group now have come out with a PDA that has a cell phone and a braille display and stuff. Would that fly?
And how much does it cost?
I actually don't know the answer to that. I'm hoping to find out and have them on the program.
Okay. Well, you get the price.
You can be sure with a braille display it's going to be, you know, expensive.
Yeah. And you just think of what the price is going to be, and you think about the size of it, and you decide whether or not everyone that you know who has a cell phone who's blind would rather use something that big. And the answer is, well, no, we'll limp along with what we've got. Besides, it only cost me a penny. There's not very. You have to remember that we, you and I, and most of the colleagues that we quote work with unquote are in an entirely different bracket than many others. And very, very many of the people who have low vision or blindness are older, and many acquired it late in life. And many, whether they're young or old, are living on fixed incomes.
Yeah.
These are all very hard, and it's very hard for them to afford even the daily things that we all want to have, like a phone. But then to have to go buy one that costs 5-10 times as much and hundreds of dollars more, you know, for many people, that's, you know, are they going to eat, you know, for a while? So the it's really hard to have things like phones and basic access. Now, you'd say, well, they don't have to have a cell phone. They could have a regular phone. And the answer is, yeah, today. But if you think regular phones aren't going to go all electronic with displays and stuff, yep, they are. And so I had a friend who was going to get an apartment. And he said, you know, I haven't even gone over there yet, and I can tell you in advance, there's two things I'm not going to be able to use. I said, well, what's that? And he said, the thermostat in the oven.
Hmm.
And I thought about it, and I went, God, he's right. The thermostats are all display-based, and you can't just go buy a Braille thermostat and screw the one off the wall and put it on there anymore, because these things are all, you know, computer-controlled and yada, yada, yada. And the oven's the same thing. It's not like a microwave where you can just go buy a different one. It's sort of like built into your apartment. And they all have displays and buttons. And so, you know, what are we going to do about them? And this goes back to what we were talking about before, that when it becomes convenient so that you have it so that wherever you are in the house when your roast is done, it bings the thing that you have in your hand instead of binging upstairs and you don't hear it and your roast burns. And that's done not for people who are blind, but for everybody, then you have a basically networked stove. And the cost for networking the stove will be less than the cost of printing the instruction manual. Okay? The cost for doing things is just plummeting. And this is what we need to keep in our head, is that the rules keep changing. So if we can just make sure that when they make it so that it does that, that at the same time, you say, well, gee, then couldn't you turn the heat off? And the answer is, oh, yeah, sure, we can do that too. Well, then, heck, why can't you make the display available so that if I'm blind and standing right in front of it, I can ask my PDA what the temperature says, or I can ask it what the display says, or, better yet, I can use my talking PDA to operate the damn thing. And again, you have to have security, you have to have safety, you have to do a lot of things so you don't accidentally, you know, turn your oven on when you think you're doing something else or whatever. So there are issues and things like that. But again, even if it just gave you the display and you had to use the real buttons, that's a cat's meow. That's a cat's meow.
Just as we look to round off, you did make a brief reference to voting before, and it really seems like major progress is being made on that score.
Yeah, there's a big move to try and stop it because of some weaknesses, but, you know, like they say, there's not a paper trail or that people, which can be easily done because when you electronically vote, you can make it so that it prints on a printer at the same time. And then they'll say, well, but the person, you know, can't see what they just voted for. Well, with the punch card systems, you couldn't see what you voted for either. You know, because you punch down through a little thing and, you know, you couldn't see which hole.
You got the dimpled Chad, yeah.
Well, that's a different issue. there are different things that are being talked about. They can be addressed. We need to be very careful that we do the voting. I don't want to say that any of those concerns are not legitimate, because they are. But to say that that is a reason to not do electronic voting is not right. It just means you need to do the electronic voting properly. And with the electronic voting comes the ability to have the device interact with the user in voice. And we actually have been doing some prototypes where the accessibility is just naturally built into it, so that you don't have sort of disability access modes. It just always does. If there's a headphone, if you pick it up, then as you vote, you can hear it. And if you have any type of vision and you can see the screen kind of, and you can see where things are even if you can't make them out, then you just touch, and whenever you touch any text, it reads it to you. So you touch the text at the top, tells you the race, you touch down the things, and you hear the choices, you touch back to the one you think you want, and that's it. You touch the circle and it checks it, it tells you that it checked exactly what you did and that you voted for this person. At the end, it confirms the votes. If you're completely blind, there's just an up and down arrow, and you can then use one set of arrows to turn the pages and another set to move up and down through the choices. And again, it's all auditory. And so these kinds of things can be done. And it not only is useful for individuals who are blind, but people with low vision, people who have reading difficulties, people who are having trouble you know, with a foreign language, you know, kind of thing, and they're trying to make sure that they understand, you know. They may even have some people where you know who you want to vote for. It's Mr. Tomaszewski. But you don't see anything that looks like it's spelled Tomaszewski. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen Tomaszewski spelled, but it's something or other, C-Z-E-U something. And
right.
I will apologize to John Tomaszewski, who I knew 25 years ago. But I forgot. I used to know how to spell his name, and I can't anymore. All I remember is that I had to memorize it because I never figured it out. But you touch the names, and you hear it, and you go, oh, that's the guy I want. So it's not something, again, that becomes a disability thing. It is something that is just, if you're having trouble reading the names, you just touch them, and they read. So that's the kind of thing that we're trying to do. And we can do the same thing in voting where, let's see, can I talk about that? There are several, yes, I can say that. There's a Phoenix Airport is putting in something to replace the telephones, and so they were putting in a system where it would put up signs and let you know when you had a page, so it was auditorily paged and visually paged so people who are deaf could see it. And then you could go over into a phone, and you could access the information. But we're also making or enter a message or whatever, and we're also making it so that it's accessible. And they actually specified in the RFP from the airport that it had to be cross disability accessible using they specified the easy access system, which is what we've been working on, because it provided that cross disability access. But we're now seeing things like this, which that's not a government facility, specifying cross disability accessibility. The San Francisco mayor's office wants to put a kiosk in City Hall at a point in the future, and so they're really interested in trying to make sure that it's cross disability accessible when it goes in, and things like this. So there's a lot of things being looked at, and there's some other ones that, some of which I can't talk about, where major places are putting stuff together and designing it from the ground up, from the beginning, to be cross-disability accessible and to be able to be used without vision at all.
Do you think one day people in the U.S.
On the spectrum.
Okay. Do you think one day people in the U.S. will be voting online via the web?
You know, the problem you have there is a fundamental one, and that is that you can't really... you can guarantee that the person voted, but you can't guarantee that they're not influenced. If you have people voting on the web, how do you know that there's not somebody standing right next to them telling them what to vote? How do you know that... We have laws that say that you can't have any electioneering within so many feet of the polling place. Well, if you're voting in an unknown place over the Internet, you have no idea where this is. You don't know if people aren't just standing there cornering people you know, on the corner of 5th and Main and handing him a laptop and saying, here, vote for so-and-so. There's no ability. So you can do the authentication. You can make sure that the person is the person. But how do you make sure that the person isn't being influenced and stuff? And so I don't know the answer. There are people who are voting experts. And so the questions come down to things like that rather than sort of, you know, accessibility and even snoopability. There's ways of doing that that are secure.
Hmm.
It's this other issue of that I don't know how to address or how to it's being addressed, and that has to do with you know, making sure that people are in fact voting and not being influenced and things. And so that's another one of the factors in there. There's also, I mean, hackers are hackers, and anytime you open up a system so it's actually on an open system that you can get at without being present, which is what you can do on if you do it over the Internet, then everybody's really afraid that what one person can build, somebody else can break.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it sounds like, particularly with the concept of a universal protocol, you're feeling pretty optimistic about the future.
Oh, I think three things. One of them is that technology will constantly give us more opportunities to make things more accessible. Two, that technology will constantly introduce new barriers you never thought of before. For example, it may be that in the future people do virtual schools, and until we figure out how to do virtual tactile, it will mean that you will basically find that more and more visualization. I'm worried very much that science and technology are going to be taught more and more using visualization techniques, and that's a real scary thing if you're blind. The third thing, though, is that if we can, first of all, the whole world's getting older. If we can get people to understand that they're all getting older and they're all going to acquire disabilities, and they better get this stuff in place out of self-preservation, number one. Number two, we're getting more knowledge and we're learning how to do this, and technology, again, is making it easier if we know how to do it right. They're now talking about things like drinking something, and little nanobots are in the thing, and they go into, and they get into your bloodstream, and then they go up and they attach themselves onto your cortex, and then you can just control things by just thinking about them. And so you don't see things, you just know them. And if it's visualization is purely a problem with the optical center, then you just create virtual images. Somebody was saying something that was a little scary, and that is the ability to simulate all of your senses so that you can actually see, feel, taste, and think that you are someplace and doing something when you, in fact, are not.
I thought they banned those sort of substances in the 60s.
Yeah, well, this one is really scary when you think of where it can go and what you can do with that in terms of messing with people. So, but in before you get to messing with people, that can be just a marvelous way of getting information in and out. So, but that's far distant. And even in the short term, I am worried that things are getting very, very complicated. I don't know how to really provide a good interface. You had raised the screen reader issue before, and I had talked about all of these things for building it in, so it was already there. And that works great. The analogy I use is when I want to turn my computer on, I don't care if I had a disability and it took me 10 times as long to turn my computer on as everybody else, because it takes me exactly 1 second to turn it on. I push a button. And if it took 10 seconds, I mean, you know, who cares? It's inconvenient, but it's nothing significant in my day. But if it takes me 10 times as long to type a character on the keyboard, I'm dead. Every 2 weeks I can do a day's worth of typing. My days are already, you know, like 12 hours long and 14 hours long. I can't deal with 10 times longer. So there are many things in our lives where we would like to have the access built in so that we can just go use it. And if it takes us a little longer to flip a light switch than it does somebody who's sighted because they can see it and they flip it and I have to feel for it and then flip it, you know, that's okay. I wouldn't want to have to carry around my own assistive technology to turn a light switch on. There are other places, though, like workstations, where efficiency is really important or I'm dead. And that's like the screen reader analogy. And then we need to have tools that really work for us. I think that we will see that things advances, and again, it's going to be agent-oriented things, I think, that's going to give us the key to unlock it. As people try and make things so that agents can operate them, then we can have agents which communicate with us the way we want to communicate, and that can be non-visually, or if we're blind, or it can be entirely visually if we're deaf. So I think it's really exciting, but you know what? There's 1,000 questions that have to be answered before we get there. And it's going to take a lot of people with a lot of vision and a lot of people who are experiencing, and this is everybody who's been had a disability for a long time, to people who just acquired disabilities and who are having to deal with a disability without a lot of skills, as providing input and insight to figure out what it is. And I want to put in one plug here. I've been asked to do a study on technologies to help people live more independently. And instead of trying to do it, which is a typical fashion of getting a bunch of scientists and technologists together to say, you know, what is it that you're doing that would be helpful to people with disabilities, I want to do it from the other end backwards, or the other end forwards, actually. And that is to start by finding out what it is that causes people to lose independence. And then to take those problems, whether they're pretty or ugly, and take them to the scientists and technologists and say, this may not be the problem you want to solve, but can you solve this problem? You know, what technology do you know? How could the research that you're doing, what new advances would help to solve these? And I'll walk into something which is not a blindness-related area, but a high spinal cord injury.
Hmm.
And you'd say the things that cause people to lose it are independence are, A, the inability to do any kind of serious hygiene except when they're in their care situation, or the problems they would have with they form ulcers. Their skin actually breaks down because they don't they can actually lean against their skin and not realize that you get uncomfortable and you move, but they, of course, don't get uncomfortable. And so you take some of these problems and you take somebody to nanotechnology and you say, what is it that you can do about personal hygiene? And they look at you and they go, I don't want to talk about personal hygiene. And you say, I know that you don't, but let's talk about the real problems. Let's not create a fancier cell phone, but let's talk about the real problems. So what would be interesting from your audience and the wide scope you have would be to have anybody who has any of the following three things could send them to me. One of them is insights. You can say, these have to be problems, and they don't have to have solutions. You don't have to have any idea how to solve them. And if you say, well, this has nothing to do with technology, but this has caused someone to lose their independence, that's perfect, okay? So what is it that are problems or conditions or things that cause people to lose independence? If you have an idea for what technologies or science could do that would help, that's great, but not required. Or if you know of people, you say, you know, there's so-and-so, and they've either done some research or, you know, they can really tell you what causes people to lose their independence. And, you know, it's not what you think it is. It's not all the common things that everybody tries to throw at you. It's this. I heard an interesting, I was at ACB the other day and was having a conversation, and somebody was talking about color sensing and the fact that how that could affect people's abilities and in scenarios that don't first occur to you. But you have somebody who's older who just went blind and who goes out and she's out with her friends and she hears one of them saying, did you see what Mary's wearing? She couldn't see what she was doing, and she wore something that either it's a terrible color mismatch or it's just dumb or socks. Anyway, she's so embarrassed that now she's afraid to go out. And if it ever happens a second time, man, she just is rather not go out than to go out and be humiliated with all of her friends.
Yeah.
She'll just, A, have a cold, have this. And as soon as she stops going out, then she starts to go in a spiral. And pretty soon she's going downhill because she's not engaged in life. And why not? Because of something as silly. And it wasn't color matching. It was something as simple as the ability to have 10 seconds in the morning of saying, hey, do I look okay? With somebody who has the same taste as she and her friends. She can't ask her grandson because, you know, you never know what she'll end up dressed like then.
That's right. And so color senses in and of themselves aren't necessarily the whole solution, are they? Because, you know, you may not know about different shades of color or what color matches with another and all those things. It's a complex thing.
Or pattern. You know, you get colors that match, but you got checks and stripes.
Right.
I mean, you're right, but people immediately say, oh, it's just a color thing, unless you know that it's not just a color thing. It's actually more than that. So, but again, if we look at the problem instead of the solution, like everybody's saying, oh, we have to have color matchers because then people won't have to worry about not being dressed appropriately, and it's like, well, it may be a piece, but actually it's a lot more complicated than that. But let's get back to the problem. The problem was that she didn't want to go out anymore because she would do things embarrassing. And it may be dressing, it may be, I don't know what it is. But these are the kinds of things that wouldn't have struck me, and it made sense after I heard it, but in a million years I wouldn't have thought of it, and neither would anybody else who isn't actually living and experiencing. So if you can provide some input to that, it's going to drive an effort to try to create a set of these things and to get scientists and research going to try to look at both applied and basic research to address some of these issues.
So by what means can people offer feedback on those issues?
Oh, you could send them to... you can send them to me. Do I want to do that?
Yeah.
I want to try and do this so that, because I want to have a, I'm going to put it to a group address that will then distribute. So just do it independence@trace.wisc.edu.
Okay. independence@trace.wisc.edu. The Trace Center has a website, I take it, as well. Certainly used to, haven't checked for a wee while. That has all sorts of interesting things on there.
Yeah, and it's trace.wisc.edu.
Okay.
Is the website. So it's just independence at and then the Trace website. Actually, it's the same address as the Trace website, but that's an email address. So.
Okay. Well, as always, it's fascinating to hear what you're up to and the progress that you're making and the thoughts you're thinking, and I very much appreciate you giving up some time to have a chat with us today.
Well, you're welcome. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to feedback and from everybody listening.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
It's time for us to log off for another week. On behalf of all of the Main Menu team, I'm Jonathan Mosen, inviting you to join us again for another Main Menu.